River Capital. Good morning, Albert. How are you doing?
Good morning. Very good, David. Thank you.
Good. Today is the 23rd of July, and we're going to talk about the second quarter performance, and talk about the performance or the outlook for the Freeburg Global Macro Hedge Fund and the Freeburg Asset Allocation Fund. Just a little bit of housekeeping. First, if you have any questions during the call, please email them to me at drothberg@niagaracapital.ca. The format is I'm going to act as an interlocutor, as I do every quarter, to give a broad outline of where we are with Albert, and then respond to questions that have already been sent to me and any questions that are sent to me during the call. After the call, a podcast will be posted on both the Freeburg website and on the Niagara website. Okay, with no further ado, Al, gone through a very dramatic couple of weeks. In Chinese stocks fell at one point by 30%. We had an enormous crisis in Greece that laid waste to the performance of a lot of macro-type funds towards the end of last month. And yet, in the midst of all of this, your performance after a rocky month earlier in the quarter has been a sea of tranquility. You're up now on the year. You're up 8% so far on the month. You're up ahead. You're ahead on this quarter. More to the point, I think your volatility has been very, very low amidst all the chaos, amidst all the drama. What's going on?
Well, I think that all that work that we put in the last 6 months to a year practically is starting to bear fruit. We have reduced significantly, as you say, volatility because of our leverage is decreased. Some of our positions and themes are beginning to flourish, starting to do well. We had a very poor April, actually, and during that time there was a number of factors that influenced us badly, that impacted us badly. Among them was a large sell-off in the airline sector. That is starting to, the market is starting to be repaired. The views that capacity increases are going to doom the cycle, the airline cycle, I think is starting to get less traction. And so we have a good recovery in airlines. We have now a very nice move in the home builder industry, in the home builders. Numbers are starting to support the bullish case. We're starting to see starts, housing starts stronger. We're getting mortgage lending stronger year over year. We're up 18% in mortgage lending now. There's practically no inventory. House prices are going up by maybe four times the rate of inflation. So that indicates that there is basically a shortage of housing, and that should do very well for the builders. The Japanese market has done well, very steady rise. We've done well with oil, persisted, remain stubbornly short, and now the market is coming back down. It had a bit of a rally before. It cost us some money, but I think that just the conviction of staying is paying off. We had a small quote-unquote disaster in gold. Our position did not do well, but it didn't cost us a lot of money. We moved that rather quickly. So, you know, I can expand on a lot of these things, but actually what we have done for the past many, many months is tighten up the portfolio and make sure and review and go over again and again the case for the positions that we have, and make sure that we have a very high level of conviction now on these positions. So I think it's starting to work, and you know, this is what I've asked everybody to be patient. They should continue to be patient, but I think we're going to have a very good end of the year.
Al, can you expand a little bit on the work that you did, talk about the leverage by comparison to what it had been, and perhaps make some mention of to what extent the focus has been increased?
Well, what let me just say that there was a change, a philosophical change, an important philosophical change that it's subtle and maybe not picked up so easily, and sometimes I have to explain it a number of times to people. And but here it is. In years ago, and I'm talking about 3, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, we used to work on the assumption that if you can more or less balance your portfolio between long, and I'm not only talking about equities, it could be risk assets, between long risk assets and short risk assets, and if we can balance it properly, we should be able to do well, because what we choose on the long side eventually will do better than the market, and what we short on the other side should do better, should go down actually, or should go down relative to the market. So the idea was to be more or less balanced and to be protected against substantial market declines or corrections. It actually did not work. It did not work. Markets have become a lot more efficient, and the timing was a serious problem. So, but what we kept going in that direction, and didn't mind having a large gross exposure, to meaning a lot of shorts and a lot of longs, because we thought, you know, it's going to work out. Well, it didn't work out because we were very early, much too early in many cases. You know, we foresaw the decline in the emerging markets, and it took years before it happened. It literally years. It took 2 years before it happened. We foresaw the increase in the rise in the home builders. Well, it's taken years before it's really, the market consolidated for 2 years without going anywhere. So those are just examples. Many, many examples we've had in the past were, I'm not talking about the wrong calls. We had a few wrong calls. For example, gold was a wrong call. But other than that, most of the problem had to do with the fact that we were off from a timing point of view. And being off from a timing point of view was disastrous when you had a lot of leverage, because if your shorts don't respond properly and they go up instead of going down, and your longs don't go up as you expect them, but they either flat or go down, now you get squeezed on both sides, and you can lose money very rapidly. So what we concluded, maybe late, but never too late, was that gross leverage was not a thing that we wanted to do. We didn't want to balance the portfolio necessarily, and we didn't want to rely on gross leverage. And we didn't want to rely on the fact that we were short and long. And so we began to look at the positions, all risk assets, as really being one. Instead of saying we are short 200% of exposure and long 200% of exposure, and therefore we net zero, we are actually long 400% of exposure in risk assets, and they can go against us. All of them can go against us at the same time. And so that was an important insight for us. That was an important moment for us. And it was difficult to change, because we were so used to doing that before. And we're used to doing it, and it was done, and it worked, and it worked well. But, you know, markets change, and you need to adapt to those things, and it takes time for you to adapt to them very often when you have them ingrained in your way of thinking. And so we started to say, no, we got to bring down the total gross leverage. True, we think that the shorts will go down, and true, we think the longs will go up, but they may not. They may not do that in the short term. They may not do that in the medium term. So we got to reduce the overall leverage. And that's what we did. We went from almost 7 times net assets, 7 times exposure to net assets, which is a lot. But in our book, that was not considered a lot because we were short and long, to under 3. We're somewhere between 2.5 and 3 at the moment, and feel very comfortable. Now, That doesn't mean that we can't that we have a net necessarily a net long exposure. We might look at a portfolio today and say, well, you know, you are long. You're far more long risk assets than you're short. It's true. We are. And we don't deny that that's the case. However, there is ways that we can manage and control that risk without going into the old way of doing things. And one way is we can move to cash much quicker than before. We have very liquid positions. Our positions are extremely liquid. I think that unlike most funds and hedge funds, we can probably liquidate all our positions within 36 hours. I'm talking about 24 hours and overnight. So number one, we can reduce our position. Number two, we can use and we will use and we have used and we will continue to use judiciously options, which are directional trades that can protect you and that you know that the most that you can lose is a limited amount of money. So really, that is the philosophical change that took place in the last year or maybe a little bit more than a year, and we think that is going to and is starting to bear fruits. And it's right for the kind of markets that we're in.
Can you sum up by giving us a little statistical, telling us the numbers? What is your leverage today? What is your leverage? What is your gross or your net exposure as of last night? Where do you stand on the year?
Well, let's see. I mean, you want me to do that by heart, so that's. Let me see if I can get it up on the screen. But
if I'm not mistaken.
I should be. I should be pretty quick with it. But
I don't want to put you in a spot where you have to respond to the decimal point. But if I'm not mistaken,
I have it here. It's fine. I have it here. I thought I had it here. Anyway, we have at the moment a leverage of about 2.7. 2.7 to 1, meaning that if you add up the value of the long positions and short positions to the net asset, we are 2.7 to 1. However, if you look at some of the positions that we have, you'll know that, for example, that we are long securities more than we are short. We are long, but of the 2.7, 1.6 is represented by long positions in stocks, and 0.5 is represented by short positions in stocks. So net, we are actually long. Okay, if in that old-fashioned way of looking at things, because we now think that sometimes you can have even a bear move and a correction, you can still be making money on the long side. It's possible. That happened to us the other way the last few years. We also have a substantial short position in oil, which represents maybe 0.3, right? 0.3, 30% of
0.3% of the 30% of the NAV.
Right. And by the way, that is the direct exposure to oil that we have, but there is also some indirect exposure to oil. For example, we're long airlines. Well, to some extent, airlines respond to the price of oil. If oil were to go up substantially, it would impact substantially or significantly the earnings of airlines. So there is some exposure to oil via airlines. There is some exposure to oil via, for example, one of the short stocks that we own, which is Petrobras, the Brazilian giant, controlled by the state anyway, but it's an oil company in some sense. So that there is exposure there. We also have a couple of oil company shorts that we think that if oil stays at the same level, they'll go bankrupt anyway. So that's an exposure to oil. So I would say that our total exposure to oil is greater than the direct exposure. It's maybe somewhere in the area of 0.5 of assets. But I'm just giving you a general picture because it also speaks about conviction. And it's, you know, one of those trades that I've been very convinced that we are in a very, very important bear market in oil, and a long-term important bear market. By that, I mean, I don't think it's a correction. I don't think we're speaking about a 2008 rebound. I don't think that we're speaking about a 1987 rebound. I think we're speaking about a commodity market that is on its way down, like, I don't know, like whale oil was 200 years ago. It's slowly going to disappear as a major factor in the market, or at least supplies will be so large that it will keep prices down. But so that's a position, and as I said, we no longer have a gold position for now, although we're watching it closely, and we have some interesting options on interest rates futures, saying that maybe the Fed will begin raising rates, and so we are kind of, we call it, protected from that event. And then, as I say, in the long positions, we, you know, I've discussed many times what we have, so we don't need to go over it again. But that's basically what it is. A very tight portfolio, very few plays, a few themes. They're very focused, and now we need to ride them.
A lot of people, I think, would be surprised, pleasantly, that you've escaped the chaos of Greece and China. Can you talk about Greece and China a bit and explain how it is that it's not become a factor for you?
Well, you know, the Greek story has been around for so long that it was not possible that it could make an impact in the market anymore, no matter what the resolution was. It's been in the headlines for 6 months, and it will say yes and a no and a yes and a no and a Greek exit and a Greek exit and a no Greek exit. And the truth is, everybody around the table knows that the Greece could not fulfill the terms of any agreement, even going forward, and that Greece could not really make a turnaround of its economy on the basis of the programs set up by the Europeans. It's just not possible. And now, if that's the case, and you know that in advance, and so you know that Greece is a small player anyway, and so if they default, 95% of the default will fall on the shoulders of the European taxpayers, and primarily Germany, and you know, France and a few other countries. Well, it's not a big deal, you know. I mean, reality is that the taxpayers in the major European countries have already lost the money. They have already lost 300 billion euros. And so now the question is how best to present it. And so it's really not a factor. And if you can see that even the market lost its the market in the beginning, anytime there was a piece of news about Greece, the market would move very sharply. Over time, the market started moving less sharply, and the volatility decreased. And I think that because it was all discounted and taken in. So is it a bad thing, what's going on in Europe? Yes, it is bad. It is bad because they're not really able to create or design a proper way of having these countries grow inside of that straitjacket, inside of the euro straitjacket. I mean, there is merit to the euro system as a currency system. But there is no merit to the integration. Each one of these countries is totally different. It's far more different than what California is to the federal government or what Puerto Rico is to the federal government. They're just different. They have different cultures and different ways of working and different ethos. And so it just won't work. I think we have to accept the idea that these countries should and can default, and if they borrow money and they can't pay, they should default. Nobody should bail them out, and therefore, if you don't bail them out and they default, they will have trouble raising money the next time, and then they'll have to be more careful. And on their own, they'll have to get a little more conservative and balance their budget. That's the principle. The principle is forget about bailouts. There's no such thing as bailouts now. So, but Europe is now overburdened with this, and with a lot of debt, and there's a lot of ill will, and it doesn't bode well for Europe in general. China's a different story, but it's just as bad. I mean, China's got a lot of debt, increased debt enormously in the last 5 years, enormously, all in an attempt to reaccelerate the economy. And it's just a it's a bad mistake. It's a very bad mistake. I think that the Chinese are finding it more and more difficult now to reaccelerate, and so the economy is falling on its own weight. We have deflation in China. Provinces that are bankrupt, banks that are literally bankrupt. Just that they're pretending that they have good assets. So China is entering a very difficult period, and to the extent, it's not the stock market that's going to make a difference to us. It's the their activity in the commodity markets. It's their activity in world trade. And so we are actually seeing it. We're actually seeing that the slowdown in China is affecting commodity prices and is bringing them down because there's less activity. So that's an important factor, and that's something that we must take into account. Speculation, crashes in their markets, things of that sort, don't have a direct impact in our markets, but they do have an impact on the domestic economy, and when they have an impact on the domestic economy, it means that there will be less world trade as a result. Or maybe there'll be a lot more exports. They will try to export their way out, putting pressure on our commodity markets and our goods markets. And there'll be much less imports from abroad, which also puts pressure on us.
But it's How does it affect us?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt. I wanted to ask you, carry on if you're not finished, but I wanted to ask you how it affects us who are investors in the fund.
Yeah, okay. So you have to have a view on commodities. And the view on commodity, for example, for us, oil is very important. And so China is very important to oil. And so what we think of China will make a difference to what and how we think of oil, at least in the near term. There are long-term factors that are pushing oil down. One of them is, for instance, this fracking in the U.S. And shale oil in the U.S. So that's a major factor. That's a new technological factor coming to the picture that has increased and will continue to increase supplies. But in the short term, in the near term, you will have demand fluctuations that will impact the price. And China is a major player. So our view of where China is going in the next 3 months or 6 months is important for us in terms of, let's say, commodity prices.
Are we insulated from events in Greece and in China? Is the present portfolio of the Global Macro Fund and the Asset Allocation Fund insulated in the event that Europe should suffer some further trauma, or in the event that China reveals itself to be even weaker than is generally anticipated? What's going to happen to those airline stocks? What's going to happen to our housing position? What's going to happen to our short oil position? What's going to happen to the NAV?
Well, here you have to separate two things. You have to separate the economic part from the financial part. From an economic point of view, the U.S. is quote-unquote insulated from events in Greece, Europe, and China, more or less within 0.5% of GDP. We either will grow 3% or 2.5% or maybe 2%. It's not going to make an enormous difference. The U.S. economy is the cycle, the economic cycle, the recovery is well-based, it's strong, and unfortunately, productivity is not doing great, and it has slowed down significantly in the last few years. But from an employment point of view, it means that there's more people required to do the same amount of work, and so levels of unemployment keep going down, and you see that now we're down to 5.4%. We may get down to 4.7 or 4.5. Who knows? But so it's well-based. It's strongly based. There's no problem from an economic point of view the cycle is strong, and therefore we want to be long cyclical stocks. The financial side, the other there's two parts, right? There's an economic part and there's a financial part. The financial part is more complicated. There, you have psychological factors at work. It may be that all that darkness, all that dark cloud that's covering China and Europe will have an impact somehow on the way managers feel in the United States about stocks. It may have an impact on European stocks, which can translate into some sentiment changes in the U.S. We do have, from a financial point of view, a problem in the U.S. because very, very low artificial interest rates have stimulated a tremendous amount of lending, credit, and debt, and deterioration in balance sheets. So we are having a problem, and the best example is the energy industry. There's been a tremendous amount of money that's gone into the energy industry, loans to many of these companies, and these companies can't repay. The price of oil does not allow them to generate enough cash to repay loans. So we have problems in the credit areas. We have problems, and we're beginning to see slight widening in the spreads, in the credit spreads. And that widening will continue for the next 2 or 3 years. Will continue. It will reach much higher levels. So there's a financial side and there's an economic side. The economic side is soundly based, should not be affected greatly by what's happening around the world. The financial side could be affected. And I think from time to time, we will get sell-offs, corrections. And the corrections will be of psychological nature, or it will be because of some default in some sector, or a run on some ETF that owns $5 billion worth of crappy bonds, junk bonds that can be sold. It can come from any one of these things. And so we have to be attuned to that. And are we protected from that second risk? I can't say we are. I can say that we are attentive to it. I can say that we will try to do that. I cannot say that we can be protected. I don't think anybody can. I don't think those things are very predictable.
Talk a little bit about Japan, if you would. How is it affected by China, and why is it that, or is it not affected by China? You have a significant long exposure to Nikkei. It's a position that's been long held. Can you expand on it a bit, please?
Well, you know, the Japanese trade, I think, is I've been calling it a no-brainer, basically a no-brainer, because the Bank of Japan is now absorbing a very significant portion of the debt. It's actually canceling it, in my view, canceling it. There's defeasance going on here. They are buying the debt, and they're putting it away, and that debt will never again come back. And at some point, the Bank of Japan will decide, in connivance with the government, just to tear up the debt. So first, they are reducing the debt problem, which Japan, the biggest problem Japan had was that the debt was impossible to service at some point, especially if rates were to go up to 2% from zero, or from 0.5% to 2%. They would never be able to service it, and taxes would have to rise to such an extent that it would destroy the economy. So that problem is taken away. That's gone. Second, by them doing this and buying the debt, the JGBs, and buying them from pension funds, banks and pension funds, they are forcing and telling them, here, I'm buying the bonds from you, you take the money, and you buy stocks. You got to rebalance your portfolio, and they're doing that. They're rebalancing their portfolios. It's got to have a bullish impact on stock prices. It has to. And so they're doing that. Number two, there is a change in the way stocks are being perceived in Japan at the moment. I think that this kind of insular attitude that they had, very poor governance, the kind of attitude that Japanese companies had for many years, where they didn't really care very much about shareholders, is changing. and now they have created an index called the Shame Index, 400 companies that are well run. They care about returns on assets. They care about returns on equity. They care about governance. And these belong in this 400 companies. Now, if you don't belong to those 400 companies, it's shame on you. And so now everybody's starting to move in that direction. Japan is it has a herd mentality, a very strong herd mentality. So now everybody's trying to do the same thing. And now we've seen operating margins have increased to maybe around 7% in the last year from 4%. It's due to expand again to maybe 8% next year. It's still lower than the U.S., but it's increasing. It's moving up. They have a very, very, very cheap yen. The yen is extremely cheap, and at some time in the future, we will think about maybe going long yen. But the yen is cheap, and so it's supportive. So the Japanese story is a no-brainer. I think that you want to be long. The truth is, the reason why we're not long more, we should be long more. We have an exposure of 35% to net assets. We really should have an exposure of 75% or maybe more. The reason we're not long more Japanese equities is simply because there's a risk. The risk is not the risk of being wrong on these factors, I believe. The risk is an external risk. Is a risk of let's say a devastating earthquake. Japan is in an earthquake area. We've seen some of them already, and it's dangerous. It's extremely dangerous, and there's been for years predictions that there will be an earthquake that will devastate Tokyo one day. It could happen. Earthquakes are not things that we can predict. Nobody can predict them. But if they happen, they're devastating. And so we can't really afford to have a higher exposure than what we have now. But I do think that without that terrible potential risk, we should own more Japanese equities. And I don't want to own any individual equities. I think that that's not our business. Our business is to call it it's more of a macro play. And you know, buying the Nikkei today is buying the very best that Japan has.
I want you to know that it's with great it requires all my powers of restraint to not ask you how to spell the word defeasance. A beautiful. I love the way you laid that in there at the beginning of the talk about Japan. Super. Can we talk a little bit about, since we spoke about the yen? We have clients who are interested in currencies. Can you speak just briefly? I know you don't have a position in the yuan and also on the euro and the Canadian.
You know, the funny thing, you ask me about things that I don't really have a strong view. I don't know. The commodity currencies react the way they're expected to react, which is weaker commodity prices bring them down. And that's what happened to the off in the Canadian. I guess that at some point, they will become cheap enough to turn with or without a turn in commodities. The euro, Greece has not affected it very much. It's more or less stable now, the 109, 110, 108 area. I don't know which way it will go. I'll tell you, the only trade that we have on in currencies, we do have a trade in currency. You want me to tell you about the yuan? The Chinese are now losing reserves rapidly. They lost last quarter $250-$300 billion. That's a lot of money. They lost maybe 8% of their reserves. So they are losing reserves, but they still have $3.5 trillion of reserves. So I'm not really sure what impact it will have on the currency. They want to become a more international currency, but I'm not sure what steps. They have to open their capital markets. They have not opened them. They've gone the other way almost in some respect. They're manipulating the capital markets. What they did trying to save China from further declines in the market. They've done all kinds of crazy things. Those are not things that are done by countries that want to have an international status for their currency. So they need they need to modernize and they need to liberalize and they need to do many things before they become a truly international currency. Regionally, they are because they're giants, and anybody trading with China has to almost abide by their rules. So Vietnam and Thailand and Philippines and all the countries that surround China do have some, probably one in their reserves. I'm saying probably, but they do trade and they do accept one. But it's not it's not going to be an international currency until they do the right things, which is they need to open up their markets and they need to liberalize. So I don't have a view. I really don't have a view whether it's going to be, it doesn't mean that it's going to get stronger or weaker. I don't know. The only trade that I have some conviction at the moment is, and we have it on, we are short Brazilian reals. I think there the case is pretty open and shut. I mean, the economy is sinking under the weight of corruption, sinking under the weight of debt. Interest rates of 40, 50, 60% per annum, consumer debt, corporate debt of 20% plus, interest rates of, there are astronomic interest rates. The economy is slowing down, bureaucracy, corruption, the slowdown is killing them because they can't service their debt. And so, and now, on top of all this, they've had a strong burst of inflation. Well beyond this is, by the way, the first country that I know in the last 10 years that has had an inflation rate that has exceeded the target range that the central bank has set, more or less. The other countries like United States, New Zealand, and so on have floated in between the top and the bottom of the range. Their top of the range, Brazil's top of the range was about 6.5%. They're now, inflation is running around 9%. So it has well exceeded the top of the range. And now the central bank is taking matters seriously. So they're raising interest rates and they're tightening money. But they're tightening money and raising interest rates at the moment where the economy is most vulnerable and in the throes of a deep recession. So we're going to end up with a depression. And what probably Brazil will need eventually, besides cleaning up everything that they've done wrong, is a lower and a cheaper currency, and especially one that will offset much of their commodity export problems. Iron ore is being affected. Many of their commodities are being affected by the declining commodity prices, so they need to have a cheaper currency. It is hard to go short the real. When I say hard, it's easy, but it's costly because interest rates, short-term interest rates in Brazil are 12, 13, 14%. So the cost of being short is heavy, but it's only a matter of time before they have to start lowering rates. When the depression becomes very, very severe, they will lower rates, and the currency will continue to drop and drop and drop and drop. So we have a short position, not enormous, not very large, but a nice position, and it's done well. There are probably other currencies in emerging markets that one can go short, Thai baht, Indonesia, the rupiah, but they're not traded in liquid markets, and they're not traded in markets that we can do a lot of business in.
Thank you. We've got time for one more question. An investor complains that we speak about the Global Macro Fund but don't devote much time or energy to talking about the Asset Allocation Fund. I think it's a true, it's an honest complaint. Can you speak about that a bit, please?
Yeah, you know, it's like a parent who speaks about his son that goes to college and never speaks about his little baby that is about 2 years old and doesn't really matter for now, right? But the truth is, the asset allocation was designed as a very conservative fund. It was designed as a conservative fund that could play the same type of themes or the same type of global direction that we have in the Global Macro Fund. and that can participate in those same ideas, but in a way that is less risky. So when I say less risky, I mean, number one, it doesn't leverage. So because it doesn't use leverage, it already is less risky. It does not go short. And by the way, that is a strange concept because, you know, when you go long or when you're long U.S. dollars or U.S. dollar assets, you're really short euro assets and you're short British pound assets. But actively, it doesn't go short markets, meaning it doesn't go short markets in a way that the losses can be greater than the capital that you have. So we don't expose our capital to losses that go beyond what we have. So it doesn't leverage. It doesn't go short. And also, importantly, it doesn't try to take advantage of, let's say, bear market and risk assets. It will not directly go short emerging markets, for example, or Brazil, for example, that we short, or Korea that we are short, because it doesn't try to make money out of those in that way. So it's more protective than it is aggressive in that it is... it doesn't take a proactive view on some of these things. So for now, example, our portfolio in the asset allocation is 50% in stocks, US, mostly U.S. stocks. Almost all of them are U.S. stocks. Housing is very well represented there. So is an index to buy technology companies, which has still got momentum, though I must admit that from a value point of view, it's a little bit beyond the normal parameters, but it's a small exposure there. And we have a small position in gold stocks, which we feel are value, real strong value, but, you know, timing is a problem for now. So 50% is stocks. 35% approximately is in U.S. TIPS, which we think is probably the single best credit security that we can find today, all around safety and return, combination of safety return. And we have a very small exposure to commodities. Basically, we're long a little bit of cocoa, which we feel is the best commodity in the whole group, at least from a long point, from the long side. And the rest is all cash. So we have a cash position of maybe around 15%. And it's defensive. You know, if right now we do see some risk in risk assets, we see the potential of some correction in risk assets, so we want to be protective. And so we build up a little bit of cash. We may build up a little bit more, a larger bond position, but I don't believe that. But that's where it is. So it's the same ideas that we have for the global macro, but it is less aggressive and less risky. And as we get older, we tend to like that product better than some of the other ones that are more aggressive.
Let's not go there, as they say.
Right.
We have Al. We try and keep it the call to 45 minutes, and we're right on the money here. So let me just remind listeners that the call, again, will be posted on the Friedberg website and on the Niagara website. And let me take this opportunity now to thank you, Al, for your time, and listeners for your time. Al, good luck going forward. As I said at the outset, it's been a remarkably stable performance in a otherwise violent sea of financial and economic trouble over the past couple of months. Keep it up. Thank you.
Thank you very much, David. Thank you, everybody. And let's hope we have a very good second half of the year.
Let's hope.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.